Welcome to episode 70. That's right. I can't believe we've been doing this for 70 episodes, but welcome to episode 70 of the Payers and Players podcast. I'm Robert. I'm here with Scott. Scott, he's going to introduce our guest for the night.
All right, great. Yeah, tonight we have on a tennis parent, Steve Miller. His son, Chad, recently signed with Northwestern. He grew up in, I guess, Cincinnati. And so, Steven, with that, can you give us a little bit of background on how, you guys got into tennis and why tennis was sort of the right sport for Chad and how you guys ended up going through the journey?
Sure. I played tennis growing up. Was a decent player, nothing obviously to the level that Chad has reached. Always enjoyed the game and played it. And I think maybe when he was nine, or sort of introduced him to it, or maybe a little bit younger, hitting balls and playing that. And he frankly loved every sport. He played everything growing up: baseball, soccer, basketball, flag football, anything you could think of, and really loved them all. And really played everything really per the season kind of thing. And then as he got a little bit older, he's played mostly baseball, tennis, and soccer, played travel soccer and really enjoyed that, the team atmosphere and the camaraderie. And, He took to tennis. He liked it. He seemed to enjoy it. He played it. He was very unique in the fact that really from the time he started training until today, his mom or I cannot recall a time when he came home and said, "I don't want to go to practice today." he put in the work and put in the time and, generally had a smile on his face. Started just playing little local events and all over, Cincinnati, a few things here and there. And then we got him in a clinic at Five Seasons. At the same time, he was still playing soccer. And really when he turned about 12, he was playing in the like the sectional tournament here to try and qualify for the Midwest Closed. And my daughter, who also played, but didn't really desire to play at the same level as he did, was being coached by Lynn McNally at the time. And I asked Lynn if she would come and take a look at Chad. And she did, and had some advice, and basically has really been his primary coach for the last, call it 6-7 years. Has really been a tremendous resource and influence. For those who don't know, she has two kids who are top. Her son John was the top tennis player in the country coming out of high school, went to Ohio State, played one there for a number of years. Her daughter Katie's a top 100 plus player on the WTA and the top doubles player, lost in the finals of the U.S. Open doubles with Coco Gauff last year. So Chad has had the unique experience of getting to train and be around some very high level players from an early age, which I think was great in most cases, but also may have created some pressure for him to perform, thinking that those types of results are normal. When obviously only very few people can achieve that level of success. He progressed really, through the system, played the regional events, played national hard courts when he was 12. I can't remember if he played he played when he was 14 also, because he played in Mobile and it was like 100 degrees and 100% humidity. I remember. I remember that. Then COVID, he has a very late birthday, so he's only 17. He won't be 18 until July. And so he missed out on his first time in Kalamazoo in 16s and played Kalamazoo last year. And about the time he was 13, 14. He was still playing soccer. He was going to sleepaway camp in the summer for 4 weeks. And, you know, it sort of came to the point where, you know, we said, you know, you got to decide what you want to do in terms of the future. You know, do you want to play a bunch of sports or do you want to specialize? And at the time he was playing a pretty high level travel soccer team and tennis. And we tried to really do both for as long as we could. And then ultimately after his sophomore year, he played high school soccer and then he gave it up and has really just focused solely on tennis. And something that has been important to him is, you know, he's had a chance to see a lot of kids. He's become friendly with a lot of kids across the country, played, you know, he's played in all the major events. He played the Orange Bowl, played the Easter Bowl, played Kalamazoo. But he has always desired to stay in school and to be a student and, excuse me, and to do tennis. And that tennis was something he loved to do, but it wasn't, you know, he wasn't willing to give up everything in order to do it, which I really think in hindsight, after seeing, you know, where we ended up, you know, really a great decision on his part. And quite honestly, one that I'm not sure that I would have made, but I'm glad that he made it for himself.
Yeah.
So Steve, what was the, you know, we're kind of in the boat you're in right now where I've got a child playing travel soccer, travel, you know, doing the tennis thing, playing for school. And do you regret, do you or your son regret giving up the soccer? Because one of the things I like about it is when the injuries do happen in tennis, and you know as well as I do that injuries are going to happen, when those injuries do happen, you've got soccer to play while the tennis injuries are healing up. What was the decision making around letting it go? And do you guys regret that? Or do you think you made the right decision?
You know, we also had the good fortune. I grew up playing tennis with Jeff Wolf, who's JJ's dad, and JJ played soccer, I think, pretty much all the way through high school, and he was an exceptional athlete. And Jeff pushed me to try and, you know, get Chad to continue to play soccer as much as he could. And I think Chad a little bit regrets giving up soccer because of the team camaraderie. And frankly, that's one of my, you know, major criticisms of the USTA is just there aren't enough team events. There isn't enough camaraderie. There's so much individualism, and also, you know, parents and kids not letting, you know, certain people be friends or train or other things that makes it a really difficult and lonely sport. And I think it's, you know, lonely enough as it is being on the other side of the net without a coach for, you know, several hours and having a soccer team and having the buddies and all that is something, you know, that he really enjoyed. And I would encourage you to stick with it, you know, as long as you possibly can. And I don't think any of us know what the kids, you know, are able to achieve. And again, you know, I am going to be critical of the USTA here. You know, they claim they don't want you to specialize at an early age. But unfortunately, given the way their point system is set up, if you don't specialize and play enough events, you're probably not going to get into the major tournaments to really test your child to see sort of what level they are and what path to take.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, you hit the nail on the head when you call it the USTA for that. You know, they do talk about, you know, team events, which they don't have nearly enough. There aren't really any at all at the sectional level. There's only one or two, you know, per year at the national level. You know, there's a year-round calendar, which makes it really difficult to even play high school tennis when, you know, you're always competing against USTA. You're having to choose one or the other. There's so many choices that they force you to make that are in the favor of early specialization, which goes, as you said, you know, contrary to what their stated, you know, objective is.
Yeah, it's
well. Let me ask you this question. So what would I, I agree with everything y'all have said 100%. My question is, how would you do it different? I think there's no doubt that college tennis is what every kid enjoys, that format, that team format, playing together, being part of a team is so much fun. But how could the USTA, because I can't really think of a way USTA could do it any different than they already are. And really what they're doing is the way pro tennis operates, outside of multiple matches on a day and so many matches on a weekend. How would you do it different?
Well, here's what I can tell you. I have pictures of the Team Cup events where, you know, all the Midwest kids played in these events. And if you ask Chad where he had the most fun, he would tell you it was playing Team Cup when he was, I don't remember if it was 12 or 14. Unfortunately, COVID took a good bit of those events away. He is playing National Team Cup, and it's something he's been looking forward to, I think, for 2 years, you know, wanting to play and be together with kids on a team. I think the USTA could do it. They could create more events and create an environment that fosters the team competition. I mean, we had the good fortune of being introduced to Ty Tucker and the Ohio State tennis program at a very early age. And Chad had the good fortune of being able to go and to hit there when he was permitted prior to, you know, the rules for the NCAA, and knowing those guys. And I would tell you, we've traveled across the country and watched Ohio State play, and you know, it's just a great atmosphere. It's just fun, and you know, that's what tennis really should be. It should be fun. I personally don't think playing a level two in Key Biscayne, Florida, when it's 90 degrees in February, and you play two doubles and two singles matches, and you start at 8:30 in the morning, which means you had to get up at 6 to have breakfast at 7, and you get off the court at 7:30, and then you have to be back on Sunday to do it all over again. It is fun, and I don't think it's fun. It's fun for a kid. And so what I'd say is, you know, they need to do a better job of making it fun, and the team events are fun. They could, you know, do away with an L2 or make, you know, one L2 all team events, or you know, if they give people the points, people are going to go and play the team events.
Right. And you know, the other thing is, you know, in the Southern section, maybe it's similar to what you had in the Midwest, but we have like what's called Southern Cup, but that's only for the top three boys and girls in each state. So, you know, Georgia, which is an incredibly deep state, North Carolina, you've got, you know, it's only available to three kids. And so you're not really making it open to a lot of the other kids that, you know, maybe they're not as serious or not as good, but they never even get to experience a team event, because every team event that, you know, I think we've seen has been at, you know, either a national level three level or Southern Cup, you know, which is, you know, again, for just the top kids in each state. So, you know, if they can make these new level fives, introduce some team events in there, make that more common. And as you say, if you put the right points on it, it will attract the players. So, you know, if they can do that, I think that will be a big step in going towards, you know, making it fun. And then they could do, you know, mixed events and things like that, where you don't really have that at all. So, you know, there are things that they can do and they've talked about, but they're just not doing.
Well, and I'm proud to hear you guys mention that the team events are the most popular, that the kids like them the most, because there's no doubt that's true for our boys, Scott. And I also am proud to hear I'm not the only one who hates getting up at 6 in the morning on a Saturday to watch two singles and two doubles and then do it all over again on Sunday. Because you're right, that's not fun either. Yeah. So I 100% agree with everything you're saying.
And I mean, I say that to him all the time. I mean, you know, I've traveled, you know, all over. We've been, to Kenosha, Wisconsin in February. We've been to Green Bay, Wisconsin, you know, in January. And I'm like, who's the person, you know what I mean, who thought this is a, you know, a good idea? And I say to him every time, if you're not having fun, we don't have to do this. You know, this should be fun. This should not, you know, should not be a job. And, you know, I'll be critical of the USTA here. You know, why are there not more interactions with the kids at the events, parties, or, you know, other things where the kids can social and mingle? Because at the end of the day, our kids are not competing against each other for spots to be the top 50 player in the world or the top 25 player in the world. They're competing against some kid from, you know, Croatia or Estonia or somewhere else. And, you know, if you talk to the best, the people who are the best, my friend David Cass grew up with him, Andre Agassi, Jim Courier, Michael Chang, you know, Ty Tucker, they all played against each other all the time and they beat the heck out of each other, but they all got better and nobody was worried about, you know, somebody figuring something out in practice. And I think, you know, that's a way that everyone, you know, could enjoy it better. I mean, I have to tell you, my son has a hit set up before a tournament and some kid will text him and say, "Hey Chad, do you want to warm up?" You know, he will immediately respond, "Hey, I have a hit already, but if you can't find somebody, you're welcome to join us." And just not enough kids, you know, are willing to do that. And, you know, yes, you may want your kid to be a pro, or yes, you may want them to get a college scholarship, but at the end of the day, most of our kids are not going to make a living with a tennis racket. And there's a lot more life skills to be dorned. And when you have a job, how do you work? You work as a team, most likely. You know, you're not an individual.
Right. And so there's a Scott, you know him, Roger Huey. He has a son, Eric Huey, who's a junior now at Duke. And I was talking to him the other day, and he used to always say this to Eric. Once he realized Eric wasn't going to be a pro and make money with his racket, just like what you said, and very few people do that, right? He said, "Man, your job is to go make lots of money, and then on the weekends go beat the local club pro, and then go back to work." Right? I mean, at this point, you have fun with it, but use what the connections you've made and the all that in through the tennis to get yourself where you want to be from a professional standpoint. And so, yeah, whether that's getting a scholarship to a university that you may not have been able to play tennis at otherwise, or whether that's the connections you make through the small tennis world that help you move in that right direction. But I agree with what you're saying. There's so many parents competing against each other to be better than the kid down the road, and they don't understand they're playing a global game, that being better than the kid down the road doesn't really matter.
Right. I never forget, Chad was playing in a tournament, and one of the parents accused me of coaching him. And this was like when he was 14. And I looked at them and I said, "Do you think if I was coaching him, he would be playing this way?" I said, "You know, you could coach most of these kids and they couldn't adjust, you know, to do these things." And I think there's, you know, so much pressure, both internal and external, that, you know, I'm sure I have put plenty as a parent, and, you know, that coaches and that kids do because they want to succeed. And it's very hard, you know, to figure that out and to figure out, you know, how to have joy in the game. And I think, you know, that's one of the problems as the kids get older, you know, I'm not sure which one of you asked, but what would I do to change it? I think there should be more thought to the USTA's system and structuring in terms of what your kid is looking to achieve. Because if your kid's just playing to have fun, I'm not sure, unless your child wants to, you should really be playing in certain higher level events. Because I don't know how getting beat 6-1, 6-1, you know what I mean, on a regular basis is fun for certain kids. And then, you know, you can group certain kids if you want to basically try and play, you know, D1 tennis. Here's the track you should take if you want to try and, you know, play Division 3 or, you know, club tennis, or you just like the game. Here's what you take. I think those types of directions, you know, getting people in the right places so that you have an opportunity to do that. I mean, the other thing, you know, that I would say I was guilty of, but I didn't really change it, was, you know, always looking for the magic person or the magic coach. And you know, you come to figure out later on, there's only one person who can make your child good, and that's your child. I mean, they can get great coaching, they can do everything else, but either your kid is going to want to do it and want to do the work and figure it out, or they're not. Now it's our job to provide, you know, the resources and the opportunities for them to do that. But there's no, unfortunately, there's no magic button or no magic place that you can take them that they can teach that to them.
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned that you were, that Chad worked a lot with Lynn McNally, Katie McNally, and John McNally's mom. You know, just as a side note, we interviewed Kevin O'Neill on the podcast a while ago, and Kevin worked, you know, with McNally's growing up. Did you ever have a chance to work with Kevin?
We know Kevin. We've seen him when he's been in town with Katie. I mean, you know, most of the work recently, Kevin's been traveling with Katie, so we have not had the fortune. I think, you know, there's been a few times that Chad has had a chance to have Kevin there, but not. But you know, we've met a lot of great, you know, people, you know, through tennis. We've had a lot of good coaches who have helped and supplemented us. You know, with Lynn, there's a guy named Devin Mullings who was an Ohio State player, played in the Olympics for the Bahamas. He's been great. You know, he spent a lot of time with Chad and traveled to tournaments with him. You know, I think as a parent, you know, it's nice to find somebody you can trust to take your child on the road sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, give your child a little bit, change of scenery and see if that helps. There's another, you know, great guy down in Florida, Hugo Armando. We've used a few times, was a former top 125, 150 player at USTA. And, you know, they just have a really great way about them. And I think it's nice for the kids, you know, to spend time with some different people, hear some different voices,
right,
provided everyone's on the same page in terms of what you're trying to achieve. I think it's complicated if you have different coaches telling the kids different things, but we've gotten to a point the last few years where everybody's really moving in the same direction and working on the same things in terms of the game style and the strategy and those kinds of things. And I think, you know, finding those people, you know, to sort of supplement your kids is important, and to try and take advantage of it. Now, you know, I have the good fortune to have, you know, a fair amount of resources available. Not everybody does, but you know, whatever you can do, obviously, I think it's beneficial.
And yeah, you know, like you say, you mentioned it is important to have different voices, but they've got to be sort of going in the same direction. How do you make sure that happens? Like you say, you know, if Lynn has a specific that she wants Chad to be working on, but he's going to Florida to play a tournament and Armando's there, does she, you know, communicate with Armando, or is that your job to say, hey, you know, we're working on this and we want, you know, this to be the focus, you know, how he plays this week. And, you know, so how do you sort of get everybody on the same page when everyone's not necessarily in the same room?
Well, he would come to visit with us, and then he would be on court generally with Lynn simultaneously hitting with Katie or John. And so that way everyone, you know, and I don't think there was really any disagreement about what, you know, his game style and what he should be playing. He likes to play an aggressive game style. We're all supportive of that. He likes to come forward. You know, not a lot of kids his age are willing to come forward, and they're all supportive of that. But it's, you know, playing, you know, in the right way and hitting the bigger targets. And they pretty consistently got the same message to him. We also use tennis analytics and video as many matches as possible. Again, you know, this is something that, you know, I'll be critical of the USTA. I don't understand why I should have to ask another parent permission to videotape a match, especially when I'm using the match for, you know, my own coaching purposes. It's not to figure out some, you know, tendency that the player, you know, has. You know, that's been a big frustration of mine.
Yeah, no, we're same boat. You know, we you know, Robert and I, we both have videoed matches, and for the most part, parents are okay with it, but the occasional one is like, no, I don't want you doing that. And it's like, well, why, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I want my coach, his coach can't be here with him. He wants to see the match. He wants to see how he plays in a match. I can't just tell him, oh, he did something on 15, or, you know, he played a point this way. He's got to see the match, you know? And, you know, the idea that we're going to use this to either, you know, catch cheating, to catch tendencies, to use it to sell to other people that are going to play him in the future, I don't get it. It's bizarre.
Yeah, and I said, you know, you want me to sign something that says I won't post it? I'm happy to sign that. You want, I mean, you know, we were just at the USTA campus for Winter Nationals, and it was a very similar thing that, you know, they want you to use their system and I can't video. And I said, why can't I video? And they said, well, you can't hang a camera on the fence. And I said, well, I don't understand. And they said, well, you'd also have to ask the other parent permission. I said, well, you said I can buy it using PlaySight. So I'm happy to still pay you the same amount. I just like my camera, my video. That way I can control it. I can get it to the tennis analytics people in a timely fashion. Because to answer your question, what we try and do is we try and have the coaches go through the videos with Chad post-match and talk about, okay, here's what you did well, and here's the areas that you can improve on. Because I think in the heat of the battle, the kids may think they did certain things, but being able to show them what actually takes place, you know, is really valuable information.
That's right. Yeah, and tennis analytics is really good. There's several tournaments, specifically ones in Rome, Georgia, that we've been to, where tennis analytics records like every court. So after the tournament, you can say, I want, you know, his second round match and his quarterfinal match or whatever, and you can right. get those, and they have all the analytics. And again, you know, maybe there was part of the waiver, you know, when we signed up for the tournament, but no one asked me if I can record that match, but they just do it. Right. But those are really useful. But there are two options. And one of them is where they cut out all the, you know, dead time between points, changeovers, et cetera. Do you think that it's useful to get all that information, or do you prefer just to have the straight playing on court? You know, if you know what I'm talking about.
I prefer getting the analytics for two reasons. One, to have a coach and review it with him. Generally, a match can be reviewed in 30 minutes plus or minus, where if you have the full footage, it's a lot longer. And secondly, the statistical breakdown that they give you, because even though, you know, some people may perceive tennis as a random game, it's not. It's a game of patterns and the way you play it. And having statistical evidence to show to a 14-year-old or 15-year-old or 16-year-old, whatever age your child is, and say, okay, look, you know, we told you that you need to focus on hitting your backhand, you know, deep and in the court, and not trying to hit winners with your backhand. You can hit winners with your forehand, and here's the errors that are acceptable, and here's the errors we should try and avoid. Having that data, and you can clearly show them, okay, here's how you did, here's how many forehand errors you had, here's how many backhand errors you had, here was your first serve percentage, here's the points you won on your first serve, here's what you won in the second serve, you know, here's how many points you won coming to net. You know, that rather than telling them things that you don't have data to back it up, it's pretty cut and dry at that point, and makes it difficult for somebody to say, well, no, that's not the case. If you say, well, you need to improve your first serve, and, you know, you're serving at, you know, pick whatever the percentage is, somewhere between 60 and 70%. Well, but you're not winning enough points. Well, why is that? Okay, let's look at the plus ones, or let's look at the other information. So I think that data is really helpful. And then, you know, we've supplemented some of that with some of Craig O'Shaughnessy's stuff, you know, in terms of understanding the patterns of play and other statistics to sort of get baseline information.
You know, one of the things I think is interesting about video, the discussion around videoing matches, is how when you want to video the match, some parents act like you're, you know, a little bit strange, or you're way too into this thing, and why do you care so much that you want to video the match? And coming from I'm an old football coach, we videoed every game, and then we reviewed the footage with the team, and no one thought that was weird in football. But in tennis, you're like this overbearing parent who is, why are you wanting to video the match? Why do you care so much? Why don't you just back off? You know, it's interesting to me, the culture of tennis, that they don't view it as a learning opportunity. You know, they view it like, why are you so into this? You know, almost accusatory. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. You know, the one thing that we always do is, you know, we tell any parent and any match we play, we're happy to provide you with, you know, the raw footage, you know, and I put literally, you know, 50, 60 matches on flash drives at my own expense and drop them in the mail and sent them to any kid who wanted a copy of the match footage. You know, I say, look, you're welcome to have the match footage just like we are. And happy to, you know, share that with you. And believe me, there's a number of matches from one of Chad's friends that were sent to colleges for his recruiting. But, you know, that's just life.
Yeah. No, it's,
you know, I go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I think it's earlier you talked about, you know, just the statistics, you know, don't lie, but if you don't have statistics and you can't, you know, explain those things to him, you know, I just wanted to share one quick story with my son. You know, he played a kid and he played this kid and he lost 0-1 to him. But, you know, it seemed like every point that went past three or four balls, he was right there with him, but he couldn't get into the rallies. And so you went back and we looked at the match and found out that he was like double faulting like two or three times a game. This is when he was like 10 or 11. And, you know, he wasn't putting returns in play, played the kid, you know, the next time he played him, he was like, all right, let's just get, you know, as Craig O'Shaughnessy says, you know what, I think you want to win the first four, but it's also a thing about surviving the first four. And, right. You know, if you can just survive the first 4 points, you're even with this kid. And went out in the next match, they split sets and everything. But it was just one of those things where if I didn't have the video to sort of back it up, because when I was watching it, I could feel that, you know, he was there with him, but the score was really lopsided. It just didn't make sense. But having that video, you could understand where the points were being lost. And once you got into it, you're there with them. So it was just, like I say, it's just it really, in my example in there was just, it was really helpful just to have the video and to be able to do that. Without it, you know, I don't think we would have learned that lesson.
Yeah, no, I think it's invaluable. And again, you know, you can show them, okay, this was correct. You did everything right. You just didn't execute, you know, and that sometimes that's okay. Or, hey, you won this point, but this, you know, you're not going to win this point many times playing, you know, this sort of style, whatever that may be.
Well, so I'd like to get your sort of thoughts on, you know, as Chad went from, you know, went through the progression, you know, 12, 14, 16s, 18s, what was sort of the biggest jump for him? You know, our kids are right now going from the 12s to the 14s, and, you know, you're starting to see, you know, when you're in the 12s, you know, everyone's sort of, you know, pre-puberty. When you get to the 14s, you've got kids that have mustaches and, you know, hair on their legs and everything. And it's like a boy playing a man. And then I'm sure that when you go from the 14s to the 16s, it's also, you know, the growth spurts are pretty much done. The kids are somewhat, you know, they're going to be who they are. And so there's another probably big jump. But what was your, you know, sort of impression of him going from, say, 12s to 14s and then 14 to 16s?
Yeah, I think 14s to 16s was definitely much more than 12s to 14s and then 16s to 18s, because you're at that age where everybody's maturing differently physically. And, you know, there can be some kids in the 16s who are overpowering other kids because the kids haven't grown. And you know, I think we tried to focus on game style and technique, you know, and building those kinds of things. And then, you know, always trying to get opportunities, you know, for him to train with better kids and with kids that weren't as good, you know, so that you could sort of see the spectrum and figure out how to work on those things. But, you know, there's definitely a lot of physical in the boys once they hit, you know, post puberty or puberty, and when are they hitting it in terms of, you know, size and speed and strength. And one thing that I always did with Chad is we tried to create some goals that he would lay out, but real goals that you could really look back and then take those goals and then say, okay, if you want to achieve this goal, this is what you're going to have to do. These are your action steps. Are you prepared to do these things? And, you know, that was sort of what guided, you know, the tournaments that he wanted to play and you know, the decisions that we made in terms of his training. I mean, you can say you want to play college tennis at a high level, but if you only want to go and train, you know, 2 days a week, that's going to be really tough unless you're some kind of a, you know, freak of a tennis player, and you know, avoiding injury and everything else. You know, I think that's another thing, you know, at the ages, and, you know, we've seen so many kids that have growth plate issues and other things from overuse, and just so many hours, on the court. And, 16s to 18s, I'd say, was a pretty significant jump as well. Just seeing the size of the kids, the speeds of the serve, the forehands, you know, all that, but he generally tend to play up because of his age and his late birthday. And if he wanted to play in whatever the big events were, he almost always had to play up because he had to get the points because he wasn't going to have enough time to get the points, you know, based on the way the system is.
Right. And, you know, you talk about, you know, the amount of time you have to put into it. You know, when you mentioned that he's going to a regular high school playing soccer, what was his sort of training regime? How did he get the hours in to keep making the progress? You know, so what did, you know, maybe you could talk about, you know, during a school year, you know, what he hit before school, after school, during school, you know, how was he getting the time at?
Yeah, for a while he was hitting in the mornings before school. That might have been 12s and 14s, and that was at like, I forgot, it was pretty early, maybe 6. He'd go and do an hour and then shower and go to school. And then there was a period where he would do like 3 days a week of tennis and 2 days a week of soccer. And I think that was really up until 14. And then after that, the game just has so much repetition to it, and to build the muscle memory and the strokes, you know, it had to build up, and you know, we saw that. And, you know, look, you had Nicholas Hang on here earlier, and he's a perfect, you know, example of a kid. I mean, I think he said at 14, he went to Spain to live, if I'm not mistaken, and didn't even and go to school. Him and Chad are good friends. He's a great, great young man, a great kid. But, yes, you know, that's a pretty huge sacrifice, you know, to make, to get the hours on court to build it. You know, his game is a great game, and it paid off for him. But, you know, burnout is definitely an issue, and it's a challenging to sort of find the right line. And then in the summertime, he definitely would train more because we had the time. But again, the USDA, you know, has the systems, and, you know, you have to play in the Midwest closed, and then, you know, the national hard court and national clay court, and, you know, those other events. And you'd be surprised how much you start looking at it, how much time goes by. And really, I think training could be emphasized much more than, you know, and try and minimize some of the tournaments. It's just really hard to do because you always feel like you're chasing.
Yeah. And like you say, you mentioned that Chad's birthday is that July birthday. So that puts him, you know, he's got to be playing, you know, if he wants to play hard courts, clay courts, those are late summer tournaments. So if he turns, you know, changes age groups during that month, he, like you say, you've got to sort of build points up in the age group that you're going into the year before. So, you know, you are, you know, and it's like, I hate the term chasing points, because there's different ways to interpret it. But I mean, if you're sort of scheduling your tournament schedule so that you can be in position to play these things, that's not really chasing points, you know, but it's just how you organize your schedule. And it's not necessarily the best thing for development either, because it is frustrating.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's one of the things that we, you know, sort of see is maybe, you know, early on, you know, the tournaments aren't as important as they are later, obviously. And so that time that you spend traveling, the money that you spend in hotels and everything could be much better be put to use at home working on your game.
Yeah. And I think, again, you know, it's hard to know because people blossom at different ages. But I would also tell you, if you know, I think tennis recruiting has an interesting statistic when you go back and look, you know, where players were ranked in sort of ninth grade, 10th grade, 11th and 12th grade. There is generally some movement, but not nearly as much, you know what I mean, as you may think. And
right.
I think the irony of that is there was an article that was written talking about not just in the US, but all junior Grand Slam champions and how few of them had actually gone on to win a professional major and what most of them have achieved in ranking. And, you know, what that tells you, and it's really hard to process, I think, as a parent, and even more hard as a child, is winning at 14s and 16s, and even sometimes at 18s, doesn't guarantee you winning later, you know, in college or post-college. There's a certain, you know, game style that's associated with, you know, the way you need to play. And, you know, one of the things that I've asked Chad to do, and, you know, I wouldn't say that you know, he's always done it is you got to focus on getting better. You can't focus on winning. And sometimes you may lose, but you're getting better. And it's, you know, looking in the long term, it's just really hard to do that because, you know, most kids want to pull up the recruiting list or the rankings list or whatever, you know, measurement it is or the UTR list and see where they are and see how they stack up.
Yeah. And that's one of the biggest frustrations I think that we have is this, you know, UTR, especially at, you know, ages 10, 11, 12 is completely meaningless, but the kids obsess over it, you know, so much at tournaments, everybody knows everyone else's UTR, you know, hey, you're this, you're that, yeah. You know, I'm going to beat you because I've got, you know, this, you know, I think UTR was something that came into effect maybe I think it was probably after Chad was maybe 13 or 14 probably. But how did you see UTR changing junior tennis as it sort of came to be the more official metric?
I think all the things you said are valid and are definitely concerns, but I think UTR is also at least a good tool to give you an idea of a range of a player's ability. I don't recall really seeing it much until sort of the latter half of maybe the 14s and then into the 16s. I do think it is helpful, especially in terms of the college journey in understanding where you need to be. If your child wants to go and play at Duke, you can pull up the players on the roster at Duke. You know what I mean? You can get a gauge of, okay, this is where they are. And this is sort of the slot that yeah. they play. I think, you yeah. know, if you could, I don't know how you'd do it, but I'd keep your kid off of the computer and not let him look until they're 13 or 14, if you could.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with that. I wish there was some way that, you know, UTR could, you know, anonymize, you know, a person's UTR until they're 14 or 15 or something. Because like you say, it is very useful, you know, when you're 16, 17, you're saying, okay, well, realistically, where can I play? You know, by that time, you should be have your game developed. You should be, you know, sort of maturing into the type of player that you're going to be. You know, when you're 11 and 12, you know, who knows how tall you're going to be? Who knows what kind of player you're going to be? There's still so many things that are evolving. And UTR is giving you this, you know, snapshot of who you are at that point, but it's not who you're going to be 4 or 5 years from now when it's more important. Now, when you're, you know, 15, 16, 17, yeah, then, you know, it's become something that you probably should have an awareness of, not obsess over it, but you should be aware of it.
Hey, Steve, do you have any opinions on regional inaccuracies in UTR? I keep seeing certain areas of the country that the kids UTR shoot up almost inaccurately, and then they get into other sections and they are losing to kids that are much lower of a UTR. Do you see that any even in the 16s and 18s?
Yeah, we definitely saw that in certain areas of the country, and we sort of would cross-reference that against some UST rankings, and there's definitely some sections that have that. You know, what I would encourage is go to the places, generally speaking, where you know the best tennis players are, you know, and that would be, you know, go to Florida and have your kid play there if you can afford it. Go to Texas and have your kid there, play there if you can afford it. Go to California and play some because, you know, regardless of what those kids UTR, you know, it's statistically because of the weather and because of other things, it's just good playing. And you know, again, we've seen it. The UTR is a good metric and a good means of information. And frankly, again, you know, I'm going to be critical of the USTA here. I wish they would use that information better than they have because they, you know, like you like me have traveled all over the country and many parents to get our kids to play these events and to move up through the system and then to show up at a national event. And there's a person who is not ranked, maybe because they're playing ITFs, maybe because they haven't played a lot of tournaments, but everyone knows the level of their game. To not see them to me seems like, you know, a real travesty, you know, to the parents who are playing within the system. You know, Nicholas Hang, I remember he had this first or second highest UTR and played a tournament in Mobile. And in the first round, he played another kid who had the first or second highest UTR. And Nick was the one seed, you know, and I'm just thinking like, gosh, and he took it great. You know, he was a great, you know, kid about it, a great trooper, but you know, we're all invested in this. We're all investing in our kids. And yeah, at the end of the day, everybody's got to play everybody, but you know, there are simple fixes to the system with the data is available, you know, that the USTA has just chosen not to look at. But
and that's also a section by section thing as well. I know that the Midwest uses UTR for seeding, which I think makes sense, whereas Southern Section wants nothing to do with the UTR. You know, they're completely opposed to giving it any validity at all. You know, maybe with this new world tennis number that's supposed to be coming out, you know, in 2019, now we're in 2022.
But why do we need another number? I mean, we have number. I mean, it's just, exactly. It's just another form of UTR. I mean, again, the USTA couldn't play nice with UTR. So they decided to come up with, you know, their own number.
Yeah. And I think like what you're saying, when you show up to a tournament, the seeding should matter. And when the one seed plays probably one of the best kids in the tournament in the very first round, that's no good for either team. I mean, if we're watching the NCAA tournament, you don't want the best two teams to play in the first round. They ought not have to play each other until they make it at least to the Elite Eight or the Final Four. It's the same in a tennis tournament. And ignoring that information, we see that happen all the time. I mean, Scott was at a tournament a couple weeks ago, and you had kids playing each other first round that shouldn't be, but the seeding's off because of what you said. One kid may just go to an academy, and he may not be playing a ton of USTA events, but everybody knows he's good here, you know? And so I agree. I wish that USTA would engage UTR. I also wish the few team tournaments that USTA does have, I wish that they would use UTR when you start the lineups of those team tournaments. Often they'll do them based on the national rankings, and you'll have one team that's way better than another because they went based on the national ranking, and some kid that doesn't play a lot of USTA events but gets into the team tournament gets on the – it'd be like what you said, those two exact players on the same team. Well, now they have a stacked team. So ignoring that information in a team event, I don't like either.
No, I completely agree. And, you know, I've asked the USTA on numerous occasions, you know, why don't you do it? I mean, you know, a perfect example is, you know, Winter Nationals, Aiden Kim, I think he's top 100 in the world in ITFs. He's in Winter Nationals. He's not seeded. And I said, guys, how is Aiden Kim not seeded in Winter Nationals? He's 85 in the world or 100 in the world in junior ITF. And they said, well, we made a decision not to. I said, well, you make a decision to Kalamazoo to do it. And I said, why would you not do it here? I mean, it'd be different if it's some kid, nobody knew who he was, and he showed up and he just ran through the field. You know, that I don't blame anybody for that. That's possible. But we've known Aiden since he was 13 years old, and she had played him in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I just, you know, I don't know if it's, you know, being stubborn or they don't want to deal with it or whatever it is. But again, like those are the kinds of things that to me are simple fixes that they could make the environment so much better for everyone. You don't have to seed them one. You don't have to seed them five. I mean, I think there was 32 seeds or at least, 32 seeds. So seed them 16, seed them 20, seed them something.
Well, and people say, you know, you went back to your fun comment. This is part of that. You got folks investing in a weekend. They're driving a long way. And just paying attention to this detail, it's not parents that are being, I think, they're not overdoing it. These are parents who just want it done well, want it done right. And ignoring information that's obvious and in your face, I think I don't understand why they do that.
And I would just say one other thing that we found exceedingly frustrating is I don't understand how the USTA allows a kid to withdraw in the main draw or in the back draw, but then continue on playing doubles. If you're not able to play, then you're not able to play. You know, and I've asked, and they've said, well, it could be certain kind of injury and you can't play singles, but you could play doubles. I'm like, really? I mean, You know, really?
Yeah. That's a weird one. But hey, Steve, I wanted to ask a couple questions about, you know, the recruiting process. I know a lot of kids are, you know, they're in that period where they're starting to think about college, and maybe there's eighth grades, you know, freshman, sophomore, but they haven't, you know, started that, you know, process where you, I think you go on visits and everything, but I want to know what Chad's experience was and your role in it as well.
Well, unfortunately, he was a victim of COVID. So it was, most of the recruiting was really during the dead period that they had for, I don't remember, I think it was 18 plus months, because usually I think it's after your junior year. And after his junior year, COVID basically hit and we couldn't do it. So, you know, what we did is, you know, I had the good fortune. We'd been to a number of tennis matches. You know, we understood how it worked. And we looked at the schools that really were a fit for him and what he wanted. And his objective was a school that had excellent academics and excellent tennis. And we started looking at, you know, where those were, both geographically and then based on his skill level. And then we reached out to those coaches, and we didn't reach out to anywhere that we felt was really, you know, too far out there. I mean, he said, "Hey, Dad, what do you think of Stanford?" So I said, "Okay, fine. I'll call the Stanford coach and talk." And we knew that was a stretch. And obviously, you know, given the quality of that school and the quality of the tennis, that really wasn't an option. But you know, that was fine. But I think also, you know, understanding where your child can fit in and where they can go. And then, look, it's a really, you know, I don't know that a lot of parents know, but I would say, number one, as a parent, be proactive. Number two, understand the level of your child and where they can play. And maybe, you know, above all of that is figure out financially where you need to be. Because, you know, for people who don't know, there's only four scholarships for a tennis team, you know, spread out over 10 kids, and the coach decides, or 11 or 12, depending on what each school carries, you know, what you need. And so, you know, certain states may be able to do certain things. You know, Florida may be able to, you know, get you in state, or Georgia in state, or, you know, other things. And you know, what coaching style, you know, go see a coach and figure out, you know, do you want to play for, you know, a Ramsey Smith or a Ty Tucker or an Andre Pedrosa, figuring out, you know, sort of where you could see it. And again, we had the good fortune of, you know, enough kids in the juniors, and you know, people who know people, and you start, you know, saying, "Hey, could I talk to your son? I'd like to learn about their experience and do some investigation." And I would just tell you, be proactive, reach out to coaches early and often, you know, go visit them, go show interest. And that's the best thing that I think you can do, to get in front of them. And, you know, we had Chad, I think, had a good process. I mean, he had a lot of really good opportunities. He felt like Northwestern was a really good fit, both academically and a tennis school, and a school that, you know, he hoped he can play in the lineup relatively soon. And, you know, what I told him when he started the process is, you know, he's free to go to any school that, you know, that he wants to, that works for him, provided, you know, it was going to get him a great education. And, you know, in terms of that, I don't think we could be any happier than, you know, to go to a university, Northwestern, we had, the other thing I'd tell you is there's been some coaches that were great in the process. You know, they said, "Hey, send us videos, send us matches, keep telling us, let us know a schedule and all that." We did it. And some, you know, who followed up a lot, and some who were totally unresponsive. And, you know, I guess it's just, you know, like anything in the world, but, you know, I would tell you, if it's something your child wants, you know, pursue it and just keep reaching out to the coach, and, you know, they'll tell you. I mean, we had one coach tell us, "Hey, look, you know, they're just not going to be a place for Chad here. You know, I appreciate your interest." And I said, "Hey, coach, no problem. I appreciate you letting me know. We'll move on. Thank you."
Yeah. And I think, like you mentioned, you know, during the COVID year, so all the players, they, you know, got that one extra year. So that took up a lot of spots too. So, I mean, really tough, really. I mean, China had a really, you know, that COVID really hit him hard in terms of tennis.
Great. Yeah. And the whole foreign piece, you know, for, you know, oh, yeah. I don't know, you know, how many, you know, I think you guys have been to a number of college matches, but, you know, Chad had a friend who had never been to a college match, who was a, you know, top 25 player, you know, a blue chip. And we took him to an Ohio State match. And I think his eyes really got, you know, opened up as to what, you know, college tennis was. And, you know, people just need to understand the arithmetic of the scholarships and the foreign players to, you know, there's one or two slots on most of these teams in a year. It's really challenging at the high level.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, well, and I think one of the important things you keep mentioning too is fit. And I see a lot of parents who encourage their child to go to a certain school and the UTR of their child's a full point or point and a half lower than anybody in the lineup, and they go anyway and they never play. And so I think part of it is looking for where the fit for you that you'll actually play. The academic piece is important, but also don't go somewhere that you're never going to step on the court, you know?
Yeah. Well, look, it gets back to what we said before. I mean, you should try and find some place your child's going to be happy. You know, I mean, Ty Tucker says he wants kids to come and he wants that to be the best part of your day. You know, the practicing, spending three and a half hours on court with him. And if you're not prepared to do that, you know what I mean? Then you shouldn't do that. And I think it's the same thing. Every school has, you know, a different way that they do it. Obviously the Ivies, great education, you know, some tennis programs there are great, but in terms of scheduling and playing other events, you know, that can be more challenging, but that may be the right fit for your child. You just got to see what, you know, where that fit is.
Yep. I think that makes sense. All right. So I'm not sure, Robert, if you have it up, but I've got some fast feed type questions for you. So quick questions, take as long as you want to answer.
Okay.
But we'll wrap it up this way. I'll start with, what's the best advice you received as a tennis parent?
Oh, gosh. one of my friends told me that I was on tilt. He said I took it way too seriously. And he said, you know, is your son going to go to college whether he plays tennis or not? And I said, yeah. He goes, well, then what are you worried about? And I said, okay, thank you. I'll keep that in mind. It's not life or death.
That's right. So I wanted to ask this earlier, but did you find that you relax as a tennis parent the more, the further you got into it, or were you?
No, I wish I
could say I didn't. Okay.
No, I mean, look, we all love our kids and we all want to do well. And, you know, we just want to figure out, you know, how to help them succeed. And you know, I really think tennis honestly is the most challenging sport there is. To ask a 14, 16 or 8-year-old to 18-year-old to stand on the court by themselves for 2.5 hours, make their own calls, deal with bad calls, really not have any coaching or anything else. I mean, there's literally no other sport like that.
Right. And kids are doing it at 10 years old. So you're right. It's pretty impressive.
That's one thing that I'd love to see the USTA do, bring coaching back. I mean, if your kid's going to play college tennis, they coach between points. Why would you not let figure out something that works, but
So
gotcha. The Robert? Next one. Yeah. And I'm going to go off of the script for a second, Scott.
Good.
I want to know what is the thing that everyone around you thinks is crazy, but you think is true?
I'm crazy. I mean, you know, I'm definitely the crazy tennis parent. I mean, again, it's just, I wanted to provide the best opportunity for my kid to succeed. And I just tried to do everything that I could do. And I think, you know, that's the way I operate my business. You know, I try and do everything I can be to be successful you know, whoever he knows he should hit with anybody, anytime, any place, play with anybody, because, you know, that's what you do. I mean, crazy. I don't know. I'm crazy. Honestly, you know, people ask me, you know, was it worth it? I don't know. At the end of the day, I mean, he's going to go to a great school, but if I had it to do over, I'd have to think about it. I think team sports, there's a lot to be said for team sports and the camaraderie of it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I told my wife the other night, I said, man, so Everett got into tennis with a little like Nickelodeon camp. And I told her, I said, I wish you had missed that flyer that encouraged you to take him to that dang camp, right? Because I agree with you on the team sport thing, but at the same time, he loves it. So, like you said, got to help them be the best they can be in it.
So what do you think is the biggest waste of time in tennis?
Gosh. Clinics.
So be more specific. So you mean like the after school thing where we have like 40 kids on six courts?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, like how hard is your kid going to get worked? And I understand that may be some people's only option, but it's just not, it's not a great option. And, you know, we were super fortunate in finding Lynn, and, you know, she treats Chad like he's one of, you know, one of hers, and he gets that level of attention and frankly, that level of love from her. And, you know, we're just really lucky. And that's what I just, you know, tell people is, you know, I do think as a parent, there's some level of activity that you need to play a role in structuring things. And then there's some level you need to pull back and just kind of let it take care of itself.
100% agree. So what would you say then is the, you got a parent that has an 8-year-old that is like at Little Mo this year and wins Little Mo, 8-year-old kid. What would you tell them is the biggest myth in junior tennis? Like, hey, don't worry about this, even though it's going to be hard for you. You're not going to listen to me, but just trust me, this doesn't matter.
That you won Little Mo. Nobody's going to know when you're 14 or 16 or 18. It's the same thing. I said,
is specific to each player, you know, the Absolutely. Right way may be different. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, everyone has a game style and, you know, we started asking Chad that, like, what's your game style? And if your kid can't articulate it, then, you know, you need to help them try and figure that out so they know what their identity is.
Right. Exactly. And so I asked what the biggest waste of time is. So what's the biggest waste of money? Maybe it's the same thing, but, you know, in tennis, I know that there's people spend a lot of money doing a lot of dumb things, but what do you think?
I think that the travel and the tournaments and, you know, are just, you know, to get certain places and how you have to get there, you know, geographically, things like that. Again, you know, I would ask the question, like, if you're having an L2, right, there's four sites for an L2 and it's in February, and you're a kid who's in the Midwest, or you're a kid who's in the Mountain West, or you're a kid who's in, you know, I don't know what the region they call Minnesota and Wisconsin, you know, and over there.
Northern.
But Northern. Why would there not be at least one site that has indoor, you know, tennis in it? Why would you take those kids and force them to go outside? You know what I mean? It just doesn't, you know, make sense. I mean, I think the travel, you know, is expensive. The coaching is expensive. The equipment's expensive. I mean, the money is a lot. And I think if, you know, more people were proactive, you know, and you could open up your home and you have two or three kids come and spend a weekend with you who are all good players, and you can find a good coach and you sort of just run your own little, you know, weekend academy, you know, I think rather than going to some tournaments and have some round robin playing some doubles and, you know, some pizza and take the kids to a movie, you know, that'll make it fun and they'll get a lot more out of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. What you said about, you know, having parents, you know, open up their homes, have kids stay with them, and kind of thing. I know that, you know, I grew up in Phoenix, and we had, back in the day, one of the big tournaments was the Fiesta Bowl, maybe around the same time as the Orange Bowl or whatever. But, you know, Sampras, Agassi played this little tournament, or not little, but a big tournament. And to come with them, they put them on the plane, and they stayed with us during the tournament. We took them around. I don't know if that's a thing anymore, but it seems like, you know, there's some places that should open up. You know, there's a tennis community. If your city's hosting a tournament, open your doors to others that are coming into town. You know, to me, that makes a lot of sense.
Well, I remember Chad played the Orange Bowl. I don't remember if it was the four, maybe it was the 14s. And he was so excited to go and play there. And, you know, they had the player party or whatever. And we went there and there was like nothing planned. There was like nothing going on. And he was so disappointed. You know, he just wanted to interact with other kids and hang out. And, you know, I don't know, you know, if you have video games or you let them toss around a Nerf football or play Frisbee or something. I mean, just, you know, I think they just has to be, you know, more interaction. I mean, there was a great article in the New York Times talking about tennis and why is it that if you finish fourth in a golf tournament, everybody thinks that's pretty good. But if you lose in the semifinals, it's not good in tennis. You know, it's just tough.
Yep, it is.
All right. So we ask all the college guys this. You probably heard us ask it. You probably know the answer, but what is your go-to restaurant on the road when y'all are on the road?
Where he loves Olive Garden.
Oh, okay.
Oh, off script.
So finally somebody that wasn't a Chipotle, Olive Garden. Yeah. Unlimited salad and all that stuff. And
breadsticks.
Yeah. Yep. Pasta, red sauce, and chicken.
That's the perfect meal on a Friday night before a tournament, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And you've given a lot of good advice for tennis parents, but what advice have you got left? And I wonder if any of that has anything to do with just taking care of his body. You know, I had a player tell my son, he said, you got to care as much about your body as you do your tennis.
I think that's a great point. I mean, I would say one other thing, I think the mind, you know, I think it's ridiculous to have a kid go out and ask them to train their body. Let's just say it's, 18 hours a week playing tennis and spend no time training your mind. That's the strongest muscle you have. It's something that, you know, we always talk about and there's always lots of room for improvement, you know, but you hear Rafa talk about it, you see Novak and, you know, the ability to control your mind and your emotions. You know, if you can do that, you'll be a long way down the path ahead of a lot of people.
Was that something that Chad maybe struggled with, you know, his maybe maturity on court that he had to improve? And specifically, how did you, when you say you train your mind, was there a mental coach? Because I know a lot of kids are using mental coaches now or reading books. How did you do that?
It was all of the above. Yeah, he struggled on court. He had a bad temper early on, still has some fieriness to him. We did try mental coaches for extended periods and you know, have had some limited success. You know, again, it's very challenging to try and figure that out, and you need to, you know, invest a significant amount of time, you know, to get down the road before you can figure out if it's working or not working. That's the challenge in it. But
did you find your most success? I found the most success with mine in just conversations that I've had with him where they weren't on the court. They were relaxed. They might've just been while we're watching TV or something, but when you can get those raw conversations, that's where I've seen the most success, not from a psychologist, but just helping him to realize what we see as parents, and then internalize it and change their behavior on court in the moment. It's like, I talk to him a lot. It's hard to think when you're emotional.
Right.
And so controlling the emotions is really difficult. I think that's difficult for me even today as an adult. So,
right.
So asking a 13-year-old to do it, who's highly competitive, is even harder, but where have you found the most success in that?
Yeah. You know, they've all told me, you know, you got to act the same way after a win or a loss and all that. I've tried to do all that. And like you said, I'm a work in progress. I got a long way to go. You know, we're asking young men and women to act a certain way. And we've spent, you know, 40 or 50 years of our life trying to figure it out. I mean, definitely, you know, having those kinds of conversations, you know, other things. The other thing that I've tried to do is, I try not to talk about tennis unless he brings it up, you know, and then we have a conversation. I mean, we just got back from the Super Bowl, you know, and doing other things, just making sure that there's other things besides tennis, you know, is really important. You know, we've had the ability to travel out west and go and do hiking and rafting and rappelling and, you know, just having other things so that it's not all tennis all the time.
Well, hey, Steve, thanks so much for coming on. There was a lot of wisdom you gave us. Appreciate your time. Good luck to Chad, and hopefully we'll see you guys down the road. Maybe we'll see you guys at Western and Southern this year.
That'll be great. So send me a note. We'd love to connect. Thank you guys for what you do for tennis. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.